Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Today's Friday, July 24th, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have a little bit of housekeeping. Of course, Mayor Victoria Garrity from Ossining, she'll be on with us in a moment or so. And unfortunately, though, Assemblymember Nader Sayish didn't conclude the Assembly session until very, very late last night, so he didn't arrive in Yonkers until about 3 o'clock this morning, so he won't be able to attend today. But we'll catch up with him next week when he'll be able to tell us what's transpired. So that's always very exciting. Well, I see the mayor is on, so let's bring her in. Bear with me a moment. Good morning, Mayor Garrity. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you today, Hezzy?
Very excited. I'm so pleased. There's so much stuff going on in Ossining. It's unfathomable. But I thought I was going to start off with the ice cream, but now I'm going to have to leave that for another week because there's no time for the ice cream this time. One thing that's very exciting, I hear that Metro North is going to begin the replacement of the Ossining Station building roof, which is very exciting because it needs replacement, and yet it's an iconic roof. So how are they going to preserve all of that, or are they not? Do we know?
Actually, yes, it's a Mediterranean slate roof, and actually, they've been working on that. So it should. I think that you've gotten some out of date information, or I don't know what I'm talking about, which is also possible because sometimes I don't deal directly with Metro North. But it's really a beautiful building. The roof needed replacement, but anybody who's ever been in there, it is. It also has a lovely, small but lovely building where we have our local coffee vendor, and then on the side, the north side, where the commuters go through, we have beautiful stained glass windows. So it is a really beautiful building and absolutely worth the effort for preserving it.
Absolutely. Well, you know, I'm probably the one that's wrong and you're probably the one that's right. Hey, you're the mayor. I'm nothing. So, well, let's get on to some other things that are exciting. What about, are you involved in any way as the mayor with regard to trying to create a reopening of the schools, or is that not in your purview?
I am not. It would be in a large city like Yonkers where the schools are under the city's purview, but in our community, I have no more role than any other parent in seeing how that goes, and I have no more inside information in how that goes than a parent. And I know that they're working, throughout the summer to figure out what are all of the options that could work for our community and how can we get enough screens to people who need it and who are the people who most need to be in classrooms. And it's really such an incredible challenge that everyone is undertaking
really
here at the same time. I have to say, I don't feel that the education that my kids got last spring was really, frankly, good enough. And so if we're going to be doing even a hybrid where they partially are learning at home, I do hope that there's a significant, improvement in the effectiveness.
Yeah, I think it's very hard. The one-to-one relationship between teacher and student is so important. I don't know even when I was younger if I would have the capacity to be focused as I would need to be, and on a computer system. So I guess I was lucky I didn't have to go through the computer thing at that time. I think it takes a lot of maturity to be engaged that way. Well, there is some good news where I know I'm on target, and that's with regard to Joyce Sharrock Cole. This is something very unique for Ossining.
Yes, we're very excited to have announced our new village historian, Joyce Sharrock Cole, and she is, I just appointed her this week. She is a lifelong resident of Ossining, and she is part of a legacy of a long-standing family in the village of Ossining, African-American family that came from Little Birdie County in North Carolina, and she is one of the founders and leaders of the Little Birdie County genealogical society, and she is a certified genealogist. She actually has a day job with the county, which includes a lot of records management and organization, and that's what her degree is in. But she's just done some really wonderful projects here in our community, helping people to learn about their own history. She's done some terrific presentations with our past village historian, as well as she did a Juneteenth presentation at a community event. She's spoken with us in the village board. So we knew what we were getting, and we knew that she would be a terrific successor for Dana White, who has been just a really really dynamic, thoughtful, unifying village historian for the last 5.5 years of my tenure. But Dana actually came to me a couple months ago and said, Dana's running for village trustee. She's running unopposed, so we're pretty confident she's going to win. But she does need, she's sort of, her mind is now going there, and she's preparing for that. And she felt like there's so much going on right now. And, the hope would be that Joyce would be appointed to be a historian at some point anyway. And why not now? Why not now while we are trying to do everything we can to amplify positive voices in the African-American community? And Joyce is absolutely that. And so this week she did her first presentation as village historian, and at that event I got to announce that she had been appointed as the new village historian. Right. She is the first Black historian in the village of Ossining. She brings so much to the position and is such a strong voice in our community already, and I think you're going to be seeing a lot more of her. The village historian is a position that people may not even know exists, and can be very quiet and can be somebody who sits in the back of a library and archives documents, or it can be somebody who goes out in the community and hears the stories of the people in our community. And when I spoke with her specifically about how she envisions the role of village historian, one of the things she said to me is she sees herself as a social historian. And one of the first projects that she's going to be focusing on is documenting this history that we're living through right now with COVID and reaching out to community members for us to create something of a time capsule to document what we have been experiencing this spring and summer. And that's emblematic of her approach to history being wanting everyone in the community to understand their role and their ancestors' role in bringing us who we are today, and then how each of us and each of our cultures have complementary and unifying experiences. And I just couldn't be happier.
Well, it's a very enlightened concept that she brings forward. There seems to be a resurgence of interest, except I haven't been here long enough to know when there was an interest in the historical perspective in the U.S. So was that lost in the 50s or before? Did we lose it after World War II? And it's been very quiet. You don't hear much celebration of any particular input from any community, whether it be on an ethnic basis or on a religious basis or any of that stuff. It seems like everyone's been sequestered in their own little world. So are we starting to see an amalgamation of people of all walks of life for the first time? Is it like the beginning, the first steps?
Well, I think there's so much that history can teach us. And should teach us if we are good students of it. I mentioned one of the guiding philosophies that Joyce has, and it was really the philosophy that was drove a program that Joyce did with Dana White, who has been our fabulous historian for the last 5.5 years. And they partnered with the Ossining schools, and really what prompted it was a concern that we were seeing more divisiveness, more divisive language, more divisive behavior in our very, very culturally diverse community, where we have a strong history of an African-American community, and we have a strong presence of a growing immigrant community from South America. And then we have Old Ossining, folks who have been here from the previous influxes of immigrant populations, whether it was from Portugal or from Italy. And sometimes in times when there's divisiveness on the large scale that can infect even a community as wonderful as ours. And the goal of the program was to help people recognize the uniformity, the uniting motivations that brought all of us here to Ossining. Mm-hmm. And the speakers were Dana, our village historian, Scott Craven, who is our town historian and is a retired Ossining police captain and grew up here in Ossining, Joy Chirac Cole, who I gave you a little bit of her background, and the name Sonny Chirac might be familiar to people. He's an Ossining legacy who is a renowned jazz guitarist, and that is her cousin. Yeah, so he comes from quite a pedigree of impressive people in Ossining and legacies in Ossining. And then there was also another person who contributed to the program is Marcia McNeil, who was the first Ecuadorian elected official in Ossining. And she's also a Republican, which I know that, that doesn't seem like it should be relevant, but in Ossining, that is actually a minority group, being a Republican.
Yeah.
And then the whole thing was translated into Spanish right there on the spot. By Rodolfo Moran, who's a leader in the Latino community in Ossining. And it was so beautiful. I got to attend it just as a community member, had the opportunity to attend it. It was such a fascinating history of Ossining and where when we began in 1813 as a new village and all of the groups who have come here and what motivated them and identifying the unifying themes. And I do think in our community, we're incredibly fortunate to have a wealth of historians who tell these stories. It's not just our Ossining Historical Society Museum, which has a terrific wealth of documents and photographs that help us tell the story, but really it's the people who then look into that and bring that to life. And I can't speak for other communities for the whole country, but in Ossining we are very fortunate to have that wealth, that resource of not just the stuff, but the people to help bring it into context and help us understand and appreciate it.
Well, when it is told, when the story of Ossining is told, and there's an audience of people, as you said, that are diverse, you sense a comfort level with the telling of the history, or does it disconnect some people? Because so many people are ignorant of the history. So it's very difficult. Is it almost like a shock to wake up to, or is it something, oh, wow, this is really great, I didn't know? I would tend to think it's the latter.
Maybe it depends. I know for folks who have been here for a while, they take pride in their history and at least have the familiarity with what the parts of it that they know about. And I think that's probably what hooks people into it, is if you know your history and you hear that part of the story, then it makes it easier for you to hear, I would think, the other parts of the story and other people's history. And I do think that that's the case. And I think what's most one of the things that I love about Ossining is people's appreciation for not just our history, but the diversity of our history and the people who are willing to investigate it and to share it with us. And hopefully that will put us in a good position to make smart decisions going forward and to be able to listen to each other on other things that are happening today.
Oh, absolutely. So does it seem that more people are immersed in the history? Is it a welcoming sort of thing, do you find? I think it's new. I don't remember it even 10 years ago. I never felt it. You know, I know my history, I think, pretty well, but that doesn't mean I know everybody's history. And they always seem to be complimentary. You know, so I've never felt, oh, my God. You know, even bad stuff didn't seem to matter. It's just part of the history. So I guess it can cause you to feel more and more part of community, I think. At least to me it did.
Yeah.
So very interesting. And everyone can be included. What was it that caused Ossining to be that way? Because I still find Ossining to be an anomaly in a very good way. I find it really cutting edge to this day. And yet the history didn't seem to be always be so great, especially with Sing Sing Prison or maybe that it got a bad name because of the prison? But there was more to Austin than the prison itself.
Right. And now we have come to a point where we can embrace the history of the prison as as integral to the history of the village of Ossining. And I'll go back to our now former village historian, Dana White, and the tremendous role that she has played in making history so accessible to people. She's a journalist. And so her approach has been very to be an investigative journalist when it comes to telling the story of Ossining. And she spent a lot of time interviewing individuals who have lived here for many years and telling their stories in a way that really only a journalist can. And that has been a really tremendous way to connect people to their history. But the Sing Sing Prison Museum, you know, it started off this project when it was first proposed, you know, well over a decade ago. It's had a few iterations. This latest, initiative with the Sing Sing Prison Museum. It's been happening for about a decade, but it started as the Sing Sing Prison Historic Museum, and that was how it was initially thought of. We have since held on to the history part of it and to be able to tell the history story of our country through law enforcement and through the prison criminal justice system, but also focusing on how can we be a center for justice to reimagine the criminal justice system going forward. And I think that really exemplifies what history should be. It should be an understanding of our past so that we can do something better in our future. And I think that's actually a really good analogy. And Dana White, who has been such a wonderful village historian, is on the board of the Sing Sing Prison Museum and has been some really fabulous, compelling presentations about the history of Sing Sing Prison and actually our whole waterfront, but the Sing Sing Prison in particular. And so it's something that we now, while it may have done had the benefit of keeping our our property taxes relatively low over the years and keeping us from allowing us to maintain our socioeconomic diversity over the years, because there's been something of a stigma, really, of having the prison in our community. And those of us who are living in our community probably don't see it that way or think of it that way at all, but I do think that that's probably a factor. If you look up and down the Hudson River, we are different from many of our neighboring Hudson River communities. And I think that is actually part of what draws the people to our community, whatever their income level is they want to be in a community that has the diversity and so many types of diversity, whether it's economic or cultural diversity. And we've been able to maintain that. And I think that's in part thanks to being a prison town.
Mm-hmm. Really? Yeah, that's what makes it so interesting, I guess. I wanted to ask you about something else. I didn't learn that much about it, but I hear that there's new legislation on the state that passed with regard to making sure that streams are kept clean, and that's now become a law. And I know that you get fresh water in the Sing Sing Spring. So, I mean, that's important for you, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm going to have to look into what the new state regulation is. Yes, our Sing Sing Kill, which is the creek that runs through our whole village, is a tributary to the Hudson River, we have done some pretty significant improvements to the quality of that water, because there is a sanitary sewer line that runs right through it, and it's a sanitary sewer line that had, you know, gotten a bunch of trees falling over it over the years, and then there would be a repair, but there wouldn't be enough prevention for the next tree. And that's why we ended up building the Sing Sing Kill Greenway, which is essentially just a sanitary sewer line with a walking path on top of it, but it's now encased in concrete. So on a local level, we have a responsibility to make those kind of improvements to ensure that there's good quality water in the spring, and then particularly this tributary to the Hudson River. But I will have to learn myself about what are the new laws coming from New York State that are going to, if they have any impact on any actions that we need to take, particularly as we make decisions about development. We're looking right now to potentially passed some wetlands legislation in the village of Ossining, and that certainly can have some overlapping interests and considerations if we're looking at anything to do with the tributaries, the streams.
I was going to speak to Assemblymember Nader Sayage about it, but he wasn't able to make it. He didn't come home until about 3 o'clock in the morning. The session lasted so long up in Albany. And I know he drives down, so I guess it must have taken, what, 2.5 to 3 hours to get down here from Albany. I'm not exactly sure because I don't drive it. whatever the case is, we'll learn about it a little bit more next week. And then, go ahead.
I was going to say I'm interested to hear how things went in Albany, because we actually had some local legislation that Sandy Galef and David Carlucci carried up for us involving the Sing Sing Prison Museum. In effect, while I'm talking to you, I'm going to just check and see if I got an email from Sandy, because we had emailed yesterday evening. What it would be is we need New York State to allow the potential for Ossining to take ownership of the property that is on Sing Sing property, but just outside the wall, that it is anticipated to become the museum. And sorry, I'm a little distracted as I'm looking to see if there's any email here. There's not anything more from State. So what they did is in order to convey state property to the local government so that we can then allow for the Sing Sing Prison Museum to operate there, they needed to bring what are the local laws. So there's several local laws. Like I think Sandy said the last time they had some local laws to consider, she had some local laws involving Indian Point. And so she'll work with the local community that she represents. But if it's anything involving state land or state policy, then it has to be passed by the full. We have to pass a home rule message requesting it, and then the local law has to be passed by the Assembly and the Senate. And our local law involving the potential ownership of the Sing Sing Prison Museum property, or the Sing Sing prison property that could become a museum, had passed in the Assembly, but as of 6:15 last night, it did not pass in the Senate. So I'm disappointed that I haven't heard from anyone one way or the other, because what that will do for us is open the door for us to be able to move forward with having more conversations with the Sing Sing Prison Museum on how we can be supportive of this project, because the New York State will not convey the building directly to a nonprofit organization. They will to municipal government. So we're trying to play this role in facilitating its success, and we'll see if New York State made that happen. It's a little thing, but it probably explains. That's an example of why the assemblyman Assemblyman Nader was there until 2:30 in the morning. I think they had a lot they were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, that was another thing about the New York State Legislature. The budget deficit is evidently quite prominent in New York State, and there's a lot of money that's owed to the state government by the federal government. But there was a deficit before, but I think it shot up from about $10 billion to like over $45 billion. So the state needs to be reimbursed that. But then, we also hear that there are problems financially with the county. There were some problems with some projects that fell through. And then, of course, COVID impressed everybody in a deleterious way. How does that look for the finances of Ossining? Does that impact you as well, or is that something that's on the horizon? Let me see. I hope I haven't lost the mayor. No, I haven't.
No, you haven't. It's my fault. So there are a number of factors there are a number of factors that we're concerned about impacting us going forward. One of them is that we do need state government to be able to get the funding from federal government for a number of things. We get a fair amount of state funding and programs. For example, we have hundreds of thousands of dollars in grants that were promised at the end of last year, and we have projects that are moving forward on. And some of them are pretty sizable. There's a pretty significant grant that's a 90-10 match, meaning that 90% of it is going to be paid for by this grant and only 10% by the local government. But the way that state grants work is you have to pay for everything in advance and then get reimbursed. right now the state yes. is putting us in a position where they're saying, well, we can't guarantee anything until we know that we're getting the federal money. But there's also, you know, the clock is also ticking on these grants, so we can't wait too long to be able to move forward with them. We're in a precarious position in that on that front. Also, the big thing, not for Village Municipal Government, but for the community at large, is school funding. And as you know, Austin has been one of the most underfunded schools for the last decade, ever since they froze foundation aid with the downturn in 2008. And so we are very, very much keeping our eye on what happens with federal funding and state funding when it comes to school districts, because the reason why Austin is one of the most tax-burdened communities, we have one of the highest effective tax rates in Westchester County, which means that for every $1,000 of value of your home, you pay more of that $1,000 of value toward local taxes in Austining than you do in most other communities in Westchester County. You'll get more money for your house. So a $400,000 house in Austining is going to be a much more substantial property than it is in, let's say, Tarrytown. But the cost per thousand of assessed value is actually higher in Austining.
Yeah.
And a large part of that is because we have very high school taxes. And part of that is because New York State is underfunding our high needs district. But then also what we're going to see just from the reality, not the federal government, but the reality of where people are and are not spending their money is they're not spending their money in shopping. And so the sales tax revenue is dropping precipitously. And that's where we're going to see, we get our sales tax revenue through the county. So the county collects all the sales tax for most of Westchester, not for White Plains and Yonkers and the big cities. But for the rest of us, they collect the sales tax and then they distribute it based on our census data at this point from 2010, the 2010 census data. But if they don't have any money, if they don't have much in that pot, then there's not much to distribute. And we're going to see a loss of revenue there. So there are a number of, I mean, that's just the start from the higher levels of government. On a local level, we'll see what happens as far as are people going to be able to pay their property taxes? Are people going to be able to move forward with developments where they pay, where they invest in our community and where they're taking out building permits for big projects? I mean, how much of an overall economic slowdown are we going to see? And are people, you know, just going to be able to make their payments? And so, but I don't think that we're going to see, we're actually in very good shape for this year, even though we're a progressive Democratic led government. We are extremely conservative. So we're in good shape relative to the overall economy this year. What we're going to see next year and the year after that is the impact potentially of the real estate market, because our assessment rules are always a year behind. So we all just got our property and we're fully assessed, meaning that the assessment value of my home today is up to date. And but that we were among the communities that a few years back, I guess it was 5 years ago now, did a whole reassessment. And we just had our 5-year mark. So they did a more thorough update. And that meant that a lot of people saw their property tax assessments go up this year, because last July the market was very strong in Austining, but you don't feel that until next July. So what did it look like this July? What did the property values look like this July? What was the real estate market? It was a very different market. So next year, all of those assessed values that went up are likely to go down, or to some degree, they're certainly not going to be higher this July than they were last July, just because of what the national economic realities are, never mind what Austinings are. And so when the assessment rule drops, then if the overall assessed value of properties in the village drops next year, then that's going to make for a very difficult budget season for my colleagues who are here in 2021 planning the 2022 budget, because if they have, you know, $1 million of assessment rolls this year, maybe $900,000 or $800,000 of assessment rolls next year for those same properties. But you're still going to have the same bills that need to be paid. You're still going to have to pay 75% of our budget goes to paying the salary and benefits of the people who work for the Village of Austining. That doesn't go down unless we cut positions. You know, it's very tricky. And the last thing we want to do is raise people's taxes. So it means we're probably going to be dipping into our fund balance, so that there's so many levers to pull, and the last thing we want to do is make things more financially difficult for people in this very financially challenging time.
Wow, heavy duty stuff. My God, that's a lot of heavy lifting. Do people recognize that, or do they just have to contend with their own personal economic situation? It's very hard, though, because they have no control over the government one way or the other. Sometimes you just have to do what you got to do, especially if there's no funding.
Yeah. I mean, I think it becomes very personal. People are looking at their own bank accounts, their own incomes dropping, and their own family circumstances, and that's really the most important job that we have as elected officials, is to look at the whole community and understand the whole community, whether anybody in my household has lost their job or not. We have to have the cognizance of the experience of everyone, and we've made a lot of allowances and extensions and forgiveness and everywhere that we can in our local bills, just to try and alleviate people's the financial demands on people to the degree that we have the power to. But it is a much bigger, more complex consideration of expenses. And this year's budget is going to be a challenging one. And next year's budget, I won't be there, but I hope that my colleagues use this year as a great opportunity for education. You know, being a local elected official is really has a lot of on the job training, and we will. I really enjoy the budget process, because as you can hear and how I speak about it, I think deeply about it, and I find it to be such a satisfying role to play in our community, to be able to be so thoughtful about the impact of these big, big decisions that we make on the lives of thousands of people in our community. And so I hope that I'll make sure that when we're doing our budget process this year, that we have two brand new members of the board, and we have one incoming member of the board, that they get as much of an education in local budgets as possible.
Well, I wish I could go on, because there's so much more to talk about, but we'll have to save it for another week. So I want to thank you again very, very much. Just have a great weekend.
A pleasure. Thanks. You too,
thank
Heavy.
You.
Be well.
All the best. Bye. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than Victoria Garrity. She's the mayor of Ossining. Always a compelling speaker, and so immersed in community. And I don't know, it almost seems like she's the mother of the village. And in many, many ways, because I don't know that she brings that sensibility and the sensitivity of just being who she is. And she's the amalgamation of being, tough and yet very, very soft. You know, she runs a gamut, which is absolutely breathtaking. I don't know even how she was able to balance all of this in her life, but very, very exciting stuff. Okay, let's take a quick break, find out what's going on in our neck of the woods, and then we'll get to some national and international news. So bear with me a moment.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. Now, in case you are interested in reaching out to the Yonkers Tribune, and we hope that you would, we've got a new number, and that number is good for the office or the cell, or leaving a text message, as well as a voicemail message. And that number is 347-415-4326. The number again is 347-415-4326. Now, I want to tell you about this story that wrote up yesterday. It's called the it's a hesitorial, which I wrote up yesterday. It's called the Black Lives Matter demonstration, allegedly promoted by Westchester County Board Legislator Ruth Walter, who represents District 15 in Bronxville, has been canceled for lack of a permit. And so the poster, predominantly disseminated by email, was headlined with the phrase, "No justice, no peace," quote unquote. And thereafter, the reader would be informed that the intent was, quote, "Vigil for George Floyd," end quote, followed by hashtag Black Lives Matter, end quote. Well, documentary evidence seen by the Bronxville Tribune, Yonkers Tribune, revealed that people were besieged on May 30, 2020, to attend a rally in front of the Bronx Town Hall on June 1st at 6 p.m. Well, interestingly, the village of Bronxville was notified in the late afternoon of May 31st of the intent for a rally the next day, June 1st. Full disclosure of the intent of the rally was not divulged to the village of Bronxville deceitfully, as they did not inform of the threat defined herein, which is what we wrote about, and you'll hear about it next. And that was on June 8th. Yet the village agreed to permit the rally to gather the following week on June 8th, not knowing that the presentation beseeching people to attend the rally. Well, rather than focusing on the evolving imagery of the Black Lives Matter movement, civil rights activist Black Panther Stokely Carmichael's Black Nationalism rally slogan of Black Power, quote unquote, originated in the 1960s, was emphasized by engaging in a raised black fist. Yet, as if mimicking parental concern, those who would attend were admonished, quote, "For your own safety, please wear a mask and remain 6 feet apart," end quote. What seemed to initially be an effort to inform and engage village of Bronxville residents to the horror that brought about George Floyd Jr.'s death in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the visceral pain of that welled among African Americans as well as other people of color, turned ominous and threatening in its intent, its language, and its tone. And what was initially considered to be a rally supportive of the concept and focus of Black Lives Matter was not. Westchester County Board Legislator Ruth Walter, representing District 15, was allegedly promoting this vigil, which was fast morphing into a demonstration not of, quote, Black Lives Matter, end quote, but something alien, ominous, and threatening. It read, quote, in capital letters, "New Rochelle, Tuckahoe, Yonkers, Bronxville, Eastchester, Scarsdale, White Plains, Pelham, Crestwood, etc." And this was followed with, quote, again in capital letters, "These are the places we need to protest," with 8 exclamation points. "Predominantly white neighborhoods," followed by 6 exclamation points. And then said, "Leave black businesses and neighborhoods," in capital letters, "alone," end quote. This was followed by the valediction, a signing off as a hashtag Black Lives Matter, end quote. It was a threat that impressed residents and proprietors and business people in Bronxville to such an extent that some businesses prepared the facade of their storefronts with wooden slabs to cover easily broken glass windows. Bronxville residents and business people were at the rally. They gathered before Bronxville Town Hall on July 8th. They stood in watch of the demonstrators and found the young demonstrators in attendance respectful, not destructive in any way, simply law-abiding. At least they proved that despite the threat of violence in the poster slash email, that they not only believed that, quote, Black Lives Matter, end quote, but that White Lives Matter, Hispanic Lives Matter, Asian Lives Matter, Indigenous Lives Matter, as do, quote, all Lives Matter, end quote. And what this writer adheres to is the principle that Westchester County Board Legislator Ruth Walter is entitled to express her perspective on any issue, as do all elected official holders. However, I do not concur that as an elected official, she can be a proponent of promoting such an event, especially because it threatens violence to businesses and, as a possible corollary, people and property. As an elected official, she is expected to lead in language and conduct and can and should participate if she believes in any specific effort and or focus. To ascribe to the concept of businesses and neighborhoods alone, end quote, is anathema to societal norms and must not be tolerated. Lest Ms. Walter consider separating her responsibilities as an elected office holder from that of her personhood, she would be undermining whatever little credibility she has left for promoting this threatening rally in the very community she is expected to represent. As an elected official with all access to Westchester County government and the government of the village of Bronxville, it is incongruous to believe that neighborhoods, or rather that legislator Walter was not familiar with her needing to gain a permit for the rally planned. Can Ms. Walter learn to adhere to protocol, ethical standards, and personal comportment without shaming the village of Bronxville and the city of Yonkers to shift to which she was elected to represent honorably? Well, I hope you like that editorial or the hesitorial. Then we was at the end of this hesitorial is another topic, one that was previously written, and it's entitled Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde Return in the Guise of Westchester County Legislator Candidate Ruth Walter, and it's written by me, Hezzy Aris. So that's the story there. Now, let's quickly look and see what else is happening on our stage. Bear with me a moment here. One second. All right, so let me move on to this screen. Bear with me a moment here as we try to catch up. This is very interesting. Evidently, France has advised its citizens not to travel to Catalonia in Spain amid a spike in coronavirus 19 cases. So, really unbelievable stuff, but so it goes. Well, let's look at what's happening in Turkey. Evidently, Istanbul's Hagia Sophia reopens as a mosque for the first time in 86 years. Let's just see. Thousands of Muslim faithful made their way to Istanbul's landmark Hagia Sophia on Friday to take part in the first prayer in 86 years at the structure that once was one of Christendom's most significant cathedrals, then a mosque and a museum before the reconversion into a Muslim place of worship. Well, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is scheduled to attend the inaugural prayer inside the 6th century monumental, along with would-be 500 dignitaries, as he fulfills what he has described as the dream of our youth, anchored in Turkey's Islamic movement. Thousands of men and women, including many who traveled from across Turkey, quickly filled a specially designated auditorium, So thousands of men and women, including many who traveled from across Turkey, quickly filled specially designated segregated areas outside of Hagia Sophia to be part of the prayers, and several camped inside the checkpoint, the police checkpoint, and rushed forward toward the Hagia Sophia and ousted the Okay, so let's just see here what I have here. Okay, I think that that's it. We've got so much to do to catch up with today, so I'm going to just wish you a good day. On Monday, we're going to be speaking to John Bailey from the White Plains Citizen Reporter, and Michael Edelman will not be able to attend. So that's very unusual for him. So that'll be a 10:15, and that's the story. So I guess that's where we're at. Have a great weekend, and all the best to you.